From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I think that they just keep digging and digging and digging, and they keep putting pressure on people that are close to the president, just like they did to us. They find people that are close to you and that have committed wrongdoing that's unassociated with you, and they put pressure on them to say whatever they want them to say. I know the president's a very busy man. He's got a lot on his plate. I think that, we have a petition for clemency into the president. We hope and pray, we won't have to go another holiday season without him.
Let me preface my remarks by telling you about the worst vote I ever cast as a member of Congress. It was in the House of Representatives. It was 1986. And because we were scared to death of crack cocaine, which was now showing up all over America, we created a 100-to-1 disparity between crack cocaine and powder cocaine sentencing. Then came a breakthrough I never expect: the election of Donald Trump as president. What does that have to do with this? He brought his son-in-law to town. And his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has a passion for prison reform because of a family experience. And he wasted no time getting involved and engaged in the effort. We worked with him throughout this whole endeavor. The net result of it last night is nothing short of an historic vote that really changes our outlook on our system of justice for the first time in decades.
The Democratic U.S. Senator Dick Durbin, he worked with Republicans, including Jared Kushner, getting a criminal justice bill through in Washington. We'll be talking about that. Also, former Illinois First Lady Patty Blagojevich, she's lobbying for her husband to be let out of prison. Does Rod Blagojevich have an ally in President Trump? And the moving vans, they've been busy in Illinois. People are leaving. We'll look at what the latest numbers show. That and more coming up on State Week. In Springfield, I'm Sean Crawford, and our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield, also Brian Mackey, Illinois Public Radio State House Editor, and Daisy Contreras, the IPR State House Reporter. So let's get started. Let's start talking about Dick Durbin. And Brian, fill us in on what this legislation we've been hearing so much about, what would it actually do, and why was it such a breakthrough?
Well, it's a breakthrough. Let's start with that. It's a breakthrough because nothing significant seems to pass in Washington these days, and particularly things that are politically perceived as challenging, like changing criminal justice laws, and things that require bipartisan cooperation, which is what happened here. What this does, it does a lot of different things. It's a very broad, sweeping bill. One of the things that's been focused on, though, is it rectifies this, and we heard Durbin talking about it at the top of the show, this disparity in sentencing between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. This was, as he said, passed in the 1980s. It sentenced crack cocaine much, much more harshly than powder cocaine. The amounts you were caught with, you had to have a much smaller amount to get a much longer prison sentence. And this contributed in part to the growth in our prison population. America imprisons a greater percentage of its population than pretty much any other Western nation, and it's among the most jailing of its own people countries in the world, which is not what you'd expect. We are not in great company there when you look at some of the other nations and the very sort of authoritarian regimes around the world that lock people up. But what this does is it says, we're going to begin to rethink our focus on just, punitive sentencing and move into a more, looking at how do we prevent crime? How do we, get people treatment, that sort of thing? Looking at the risks that people actually pose, making prison more about incapacitating people who really need to be kept away from society because they're very dangerous, and less simply about locking someone up and throwing away the key.
And Brian, I think that what I'd read, Durbin and Kushner met together quite a bit, had dinner together. They really worked outside of what you might consider the traditional Washington establishment, trying to put together some type of legislation. Kushner has this background, was mentioned at the top of the show, that his father was sent to prison. So he has an interest in this issue as well.
Yeah, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times really had a nice rundown of this sort of sidebar to the main story. And you have this at least two times where Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump have Dick Durbin over to a dinner party at their house last year. And as you mentioned, Jared Kushner has a very personal interest in criminal justice matters. His father went to federal prison for about 2 years, a little more than a decade ago. Incidentally, he was locked up by a U.S. attorney at the time named Chris Christie, which some have said, and Lynn points this out in her article, some have said that's why Christie has never really gotten a job in the Trump administration, despite being such an early and vehement supporter on the campaign trail. But they work together, and even as their Durbin and President Trump's relationship soured, remember, Dick Durbin was the person who revealed the president's alleged statements about certain African nations being blank whole countries. And things seemed to really go south between the two of them at that point. But because of this relationship with Jared Kushner, apparently, they were able to keep working on this issue and get it through.
And Charlie, this is kind of the way things have been done for years. I mean, this type of approach to getting complex pieces of legislation through, even though maybe people are coming at it from different points of view, different parties, this, I would think, gives people some hope that both parties, both sides can work together.
Well, this is an issue that even here in Illinois has seemed to foster cooperation. And I think part of it, as Durbin alluded to, back in the 80s, we were very much law and order, tough on crime. And I remember individual legislators telling me, yeah, this is a bad bill. Legislation that increases the penalty, for example, for attacking a senior citizen or for committing some crime within so many feet of a schoolyard. They'd say, well, this is really not a good idea, but if I don't vote for it, I'll get clobbered the next election. And so we had all these punitive measures. To his credit, Governor Rauner has dealt with this issue, and we've made some significant strides here in Illinois. We're trying to reduce our prison population. And I think part of it is there's people are coming at it from different angles. The bleeding heart liberals, if you will, look at it and say, well, this isn't fair. We shouldn't just lock them up, throw away the key, and forget about these people. We should try and rehabilitate them, particularly people who are there for nonviolent offenses, somebody who's in there maybe for being a shoplifter, maybe snorting cocaine. We should try and help them turn their lives around, give them the drug abuse treatment that they need, give them the educational skills, give them the opportunity to get licenses to practice a profession when they're out. And that school of thought is matched on the conservative side by people who are saying, look, it's costing us a fortune to keep these guys locked up. They don't really present a danger to society. Let's look at this from an economic point of view. What's the return on investment? How can we cut our costs on prisons? And so those two schools of thought seem to have merged. And as I say, we've made progress here in Illinois. Now there's progress on the national front.
And Brian, before we move off this topic, can you give us sort of an update on the progress that has been made in the state of Illinois? I know that Governor Rauner even had made this an issue when he's been in office, since he took over office.
Yeah, no, and it's great, because actually, as Charlie was talking, I got an email back from the Department of Corrections. I'd asked them, what is the inmate population? So they say as of Thursday, December 20th, there were 40,126 people in the Department of Corrections. That is a decline of more than 8,600 people in the last 4 years or so. 16%. Now, I talked to David Olson, who's a professor of criminal justice at Loyola University of Chicago. He's one of the foremost experts on studying crime in Illinois and how people get into prison. You know, he says there are really two things that drive the prison population: admissions to prison, that is how many people are going in, and how long they stay. And he does all these analyses and figures out, you know, what counties are sending people to prison, why they're sending them there, how they're locking them up. And he says it's really not the actual changes in law that we've had and the proposals from Governor Rauner's Criminal Justice Commission being enacted that have driven the decline in the prison population. He really says that fewer people are just being arrested in Illinois. And that's in part a decision of law enforcement to stop focusing as much on arresting people for drug crimes. And you have other factors playing into that, like the state's attorney in Cook County made Kim Fox ran on a sort of progressive platform, and she sort of unilaterally decided to change her prosecution standards for retail theft. So this is I don't want to spend too much time in the weeds on this, but you know, right now in Illinois, if you steal, you know, $500 worth of goods, that is considered a felony level of retail theft. Well, that law was passed decades ago when $500 meant a huge, you know, deep television, right? A big tube television. And I mean, that was a huge thing. Now you can fit $500 into your pocket in the form of a smartphone. And so that number has not kept up with inflation. The severity of that crime in a couple of decades ago when it was passed was much more than it is, or I should say less than it is now, however you want to phrase that. But anyways, Kim Fox unilaterally decided we are going to stop sending as many people, you know, prosecuting them for felony level retail theft and just sort of change that number threshold herself. So, you know, just to wrap this point up, one of the most interesting things that Olson, the criminologist, pointed out to me is that looking at the decline in Illinois' prison population in the last few years, 14% of that, 14%, so a huge share of that decline in the prison population is related to a decrease in drug prosecutions in just three Chicago neighborhoods. So that shows how even if the laws are not necessarily changing, and they are beginning to now, but even before that happens, there is just a different attitude and mood among prosecutors and police and everyone else in the criminal justice system.
Well, that's the prison population. Let's turn our attention to the general population. Daisy, some news out this week, not necessarily good news for the state of Illinois.
Yeah, so in the latest Census Bureau data released this week, Illinois has lost population for the fifth year in a row. So just from 2017 to 2018, about 45,000 residents left the state. And this was a greater drop from last year when the state had only lost 40,000 residents. We are still the sixth largest state in the country, but according to experts, we are the only state in the Midwest with significant population loss. And I think it's not just retirees leaving, but also young working people who are finding opportunities in surrounding states. Some suggest that pension reform in Illinois would encourage more people to stay. Some say that immigrants are still coming in. So in many cases, that could be what's keeping the state going, which brings us to the next issue. With these new numbers coming out this week, it's also estimated that Illinois is set to lose one congressional seat come 2020, as well as one electoral vote when selecting a president.
And maybe even more than one, I guess, is a real possibility. Mm-hmm. Charlie, why is this such a big deal beyond just the congressional stuff? But I mean, not having, continuing to see these type of population losses, it's just not a good thing going forward for the state of Illinois, I would think.
No, and I think another thing that the census pointed out, if I'm not mistaken, and Daisy, you can correct me if I'm wrong, the deaths outnumbered the births, and that figures into it too. We have an older population, an aging population, and that puts increased stress on the budget because, for one thing, retirees don't pay income tax in Illinois. For another thing, retirees in many cases wind up in nursing homes, and they become wards of the state. A big chunk of the health care and family services budget goes to pay nursing home costs, something like maybe two-thirds of the nursing home beds or more in the state of Illinois are paid for through Medicaid. So as our population changes and we don't have births to make up for the people who pass on, and we're also losing, as Daisy said, younger people moving out, it puts the state in a difficult position financially and able to raise the money needed to pay for the services that people expect.
And, you know, the issue is much more serious, I think, in central and southern Illinois, where population loss seems to be the highest. Chicago is losing people, but because some of the suburbs are growing, congressional districts in the areas are not in danger. I recently reported on the big retail giant Walmart that's leaving small towns across the country and what that means for the economy and for these small towns. Just this summer, two Walmarts closed in central Illinois, leaving these communities scrambling to get used to living without the convenience of a Walmart. So we're talking jobs being lost, basic necessities under one roof. And one reason Walmart gave for leaving is that the towns aren't able to sustain the stores. Again, again, like Charlie said, an aging population and population decline are big factors here. There are also issues of increasing poverty in rural Illinois, so people aren't spending a lot of money. Walmart and other retail stores are looking to move into cities where people will spend that money. So experts say these closures will continue to happen unless the state is able to do something to retain people, to keep them from leaving the state and creating jobs as well and funding higher education.
And Brian also.
Yeah, this is not a new phenomenon in the sense if you go back and look at the results of the 2010 census and compare it to the 2000 census, the state itself showed a population growth. But if you look at a county-by-county breakdown, large swaths of western Illinois and southern Illinois showed population loss from the turn of the century to 2010 in those counties. And if you discount the growth in the people who identify themselves as being Hispanic, the state as a whole would have lost population. So all our growth in the first decade of this century was attributable to the fact that our Hispanic population increased pretty strongly.
And Brian, politically, there's certainly a lot of folks who have different ideas as to why all of this is happening.
Yeah, and I made that point in a story this week. Anyone who says that this is because of the tax increase or something like that, that is speculation. That's making a political point. That is not borne out. The Census Bureau, when they look at these population numbers and make these estimates, they're not asking people why they leave. And I do want to mention one thing. Charlie, you mentioned that deaths were outnumbering births. I don't think that's right. I think births are slowing, but we are still have births exceeding deaths, at least in terms of the rate per, 1,000 Illinoisans.
Does that apply to the actual numbers, though?
I'd have to look up. But the rate of births is still greater than the rate of death in Illinois. I remember that. But I do want to look at this on the political example here. The best research I've seen on the point of who is leaving Illinois, because, again, you do have groups, and we certainly saw there's a libertarian conservative policy group that put out a press release within an hour or two of the census figures saying, look, this is because of the tax increase. But there's two researchers, one Natalie Davila and Mike Clemens. They both used to work at the Department of Revenue. She's an economist who was director of research there. He was in charge of policy and communications. And they have, this was a couple years old now, but they looked at combined IRS data with census data and found that 18 and 19-year-olds are the biggest group of people leaving the state. Why is that? Well, they're going to college elsewhere. So what are the policy implications of this? It suits some people to say, well, it's because of the tax increase. People are leaving. They don't want to pay the higher tax rates. But it's not as though college kids, most of them are paying taxes. Even if you're working your way through school, you're not paying a great deal of taxes unless you've got one sweet job on campus. You have this idea out there that it's that it's the tax policy that needs to change because people are leaving. Well, another way to look at it is to say, well, perhaps we should be doing more to make Illinois higher education more attractive. And that would keep people in state, and that could help stem the population loss. Another thing here, somebody mentioned, I think Charlie mentioned, that this is an older trend. You can see it going back to the 2010 and 2000 census. Well, these same researchers I was citing, they've found that there has been out-migration from Illinois basically for more than a century, every year except 1947, where you had the demobilization after World War II, a lot of soldiers and sailors coming back to Illinois. But almost every year for about a century since then, more people have left Illinois than have come here.
Well, I know somebody that does want to move back to the state of Illinois, Rod Blagojevich. He's right now in a Colorado federal prison serving a sentence for corruption. And the former Illinois First Lady, Patty Blagojevich, was on TV recently lobbying again for Rod Blagojevich to be let out and claiming basically that his imprisonment and his sentence was unfair. Brian, give us the quick overview of what she had to say. What point is she trying to make?
She is trying to, it seems like she is using the technique that we have heard a lot of people using to try and communicate directly to the president, and that's going on cable television news, specifically Fox News. And she was on there this week, and we've heard this message from her before, but she makes these points about how, look at the in what they did to my husband. They took ordinary political acts and tried to say they were criminal. This is just normal politics, and they criminalized it, and they railroaded him, and they flipped his, you know, they found these other people who weren't really related to us who were doing criminal things, and they used them against us, and it's just like what's happening to President Trump, as this week we had stories about, in you know, the Mueller investigation and other investigations continuing to reach into his administration, looking at spending on his from his inauguration events. And you know, what I would add as a sort of fact check on that is that, you know, it wasn't just prosecutors. It was a jury. It was a judge. It was an appellate court that found Blagojevich was not, you know, simply doing political horse trading. In fact, an appellate court did say that and tossed out the, you know, the most famous charge of him so-called selling Barack Obama's Senate seat. But he also basically demanded campaign contributions in order to increase reimbursement rates to a children's hospital. And that was what was decided by a jury, by a judge, by and reviewed by appellate judges, that is criminal conduct. And so, nevertheless, Blagojevich has pretty much exhausted his court appeals, and his only hope to get out is to go to one of his former bosses on the Celebrity Apprentice, and that's President Trump, and get clemency from him.
Yeah, and so, I mean, this past weekend, the president tweeted about that same Fox News interview with Patty, saying that the interview was, quote, required television watching. And in May, President Trump told reporters that he thought Blagojevich had gone to jail for, quote, being stupid, and because he said things many other politicians would say. So, yeah, Patty and supporters are now looking to President Trump as their only hope for clemency.
And, Charlie, I don't want to get into all the legal maneuvering here necessarily and all the questions of whether or not he should have been sentenced or not. We've discussed this before, but I think it'd be good to bring back up again, is that there are many people who felt that Rob Blagojevich should go to prison, but felt that the sentence was unfair, the length of the sentence. Your thoughts on that, and whether or not that might have something to do with, you know, whether the president decides to offer him some type of support here, or anybody else for that matter.
Can I take a pass on that one?
Well, I mean, I know that you think that Rob Blagojevich caused a lot of harm to the state of Illinois.
Yeah, I think Blagojevich did not help the state of Illinois very much at all. In my opinion, he was not as bad a governor as Bruce Rauner has been, simply because we did not go without a budget. We did not cripple higher education to the same extent as happened under Rauner. But there's no doubt that Blagojevich was a crook. If you read the earliest documents involving some of his co-conspirators, the U.S. attorney alleged in those documents that there was this conspiracy going on, and one of the people who was conspiring was this Individual A. Well, it was pretty clear Individual A was Rod Blagojevich. And even before he was elected, they were scheming, he and his cronies, how can we use the governorship to enrich ourselves? And that was Blagojevich's motive. Now, he pushed popular liberal ideas like universal health care in part because he wanted to run for the presidency. And I think he was very upset when Barack Obama beat him to the punch. But yeah, I think he was guilty as all get out. And the fact that the damning tapes covered, 6 months of his administration makes you wonder what happened in the previous 5.5 years.
Well, Charlie, go ahead, Brian.
Just to amplify Charlie's point, there's a clip that was part of the trial, a wiretap, and this is just a verbatim quote from Blagojevich. It goes to the idea that, you know, they were scheming for corruption even before he won office. The quote is, quote, you know, our mantra was, you know, before election night was win on Tuesday. You guys remember this? Win on Tuesday, bleep everybody on Wednesday, and quit on Thursday.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, Brian, when you look back at his time in office, this followed right on the heels of another governor being caught up in a corruption scandal and going to prison, George Ryan. Yet George Ryan got about half the sentence that Rod Blagojevich did. So as somebody who follows criminal justice, can you explain why that's the case? Why did he get so long?
Well, and that's where you get some of the arbitrariness in our judicial system. You get a judge who is particularly stern or just something about the defendant not seeming contrite enough or fights things a lot. Remember, Blagojevich went through not one but two trials because there was a mistrial on all but one charge in his first trial. The judge decided to throw the book at him. And there was even an opportunity to revisit where the appellate court sent it back for resentencing after having vacated a number of the charges. And the judge said, no, prison length of sentence stays the same. But he does have other allies. U.S. Senator Dick Durbin has been on record saying he thinks the sentence is excessive and would like to see Blagojevich get some time off of that. I believe at this point he has served pretty much as long as George Ryan did for his entire sentence, if not more. I don't know the exact numbers there, but it's close. I think Ryan got 6 years, and Blagojevich has been in for 5 or 6 now.
Well, before our time gets away, let's also touch on the fact that the incoming governor, Governor-elect J.B. Pritzker, did name 3 deputy governors this week. And Charlie, I'll turn this one over to you. He named 3 people, including State Representative Christian Mitchell, who's been working, of course, with the Democratic Party in an interim capacity here, former Chicago Board of Education head Jesse Ruiz, and the former Illinois Comptroller Dan Hines, all to these deputy governor positions. Surprised by that move?
I'm surprised in the sense that I can't recall another governor having multiple deputies by title, although in most administrations, the governor himself does not personally watch the day-to-day maneuverings of every state agency. He usually has people within his staff who are assigned responsibilities, so I think that's what's going to happen here. Each of those individuals will have an area they may look at. Ruiz, for example, may oversee all of education, K-12, higher education. That would seem logical. Mitchell could overlook human services. Hines could be looking at the financial stuff and DOT. I mean, I don't know that's how it's going to happen, but I can see how you would apportion up the oversight from the governor's office over the department heads and the agencies among multiple people.
Well, then more details on this likely to come out here as we get a little bit closer to J.B. Pritzker taking office in January. Time now for our notes from the field. Daisy?
The Illinois Legislative Ethics Commission chose a permanent inspector general this week to investigate complaints against lawmakers. Carol Pope is a former prosecutor and circuit judge. She will be the first permanent inspector general in 4 years. She is slated to replace former federal prosecutor Julie Porter, who temporarily took the job last year when there was criticism over the handling of sexual harassment complaints against lawmakers.
Okay. And Brian?
Just a brief follow-up to something we discussed earlier this year. State Senator Kyle McCarter has been nominated by President Trump to be the U.S. ambassador to the East African nation of Kenya. And he had been sort of bottled up in the Foreign Relations Committee for a very long time. He was nominated in May. There was a hearing at the end of July. Well, finally, at the mid-December, his nomination was favorably reported out of the committee. It's now before the full Senate. He could be confirmed, or the Senate could run out of time and not take action, and the president would likely have to resubmit his nomination to the new Congress next year.
Members of our broadcast this week included Charlie Wheeler, Brian Mackey, and Daisy Contreras. Get a podcast of the show at nprillinois.org and also find us on NPR One. Production assistance for the program today provided by Bob Meyer. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.